A lot of folk come here this week to be able to disconnect and disassociate and get away from their normal settings. I'm here this week at the end of my sabbatical. This is my gearing back into normalcy, which is a little bit different way of using Holden than what I normally have, but that is, in fact, what is going on right now. For the last 6 months, I've been on sabbatical, and after spending 4 weeks disassociating and kind of disconnecting and recharging batteries, and then interspersed with through the sabbatical were 4 weeks of specific conferences. The rest of the sabbatical time has been spent visiting congregations, ELCA congregations, Lutheran congregations, in regions 1 through 4. Now, that's virtually everything west of the Mississippi, with the exception of Iowa, which happens to be in region 5. And the only reason I didn't have anything against Iowa is just they were in a different region, and to get statistics on another whole region was more than what I wanted to be able to do. So I simply used regions 1 through 4. Visiting congregations where the worship attendance, or the average worship attendance for the congregation, has been increasing at a level that exceeds the demographics or the demographic growth of the community in which they are located. The idea being, if a congregation is in a booming community and the community is growing at 20% and the congregation is really only growing at 10%, while that may be growing, it's still falling behind what's happening in the community around them. And so my question was, let's look at congregations where worship attendance is growing at a level that exceeds the demographic growth of the community. I also chose to factor out congregations of less than 10 years existence, because I was interested in really trying to see what can be done in existing congregations to reestablish or establish that kind of mission orientation that is often present as a new congregation is being formed. So I was looking for congregations with 10 years of life already existent. And I was then looking for congregations where worship attendance, average worship attendance, was 150 folk or more. And I was doing that simply because that's closer to the size congregations that we have in our cluster. It's closer to the size congregation that I serve. And it's a size that will not be skewed significantly by one family joining or one family leaving. It's a congregational size that is going to take some flux. I will admit to the fact that I chose the topic for a number of reasons. First of all, I suspect that it's because I've had a concern about church growth that has been increasing for a number of years. I've been closeted at that point, quite honestly, because I haven't been terribly wild about any of the evangelism programs that I have seen, and I have been even less wild about the ambience that has gone along with them. And so I haven't really been known within our area or within our synod as one who was big into evangelism. That was one of the reasons that I chose it, is because it has become an increasing concern. Secondly, it's a hot topic. Church growth is currently a very real concern within the ELCA. Thirdly, it's because I'm not real wild about what I think has been our church's primary way of doing growth, and that has been heavily related to starting new congregations, which I think has become a financial real difficulty for us. I also think that there are some things about how close that starts to put congregations in metropolitan areas, and there's all kinds of stuff that we can add to that. So anyway, that's part of the reason that I chose the topic. My title here tonight is Congregational Growth, So What Are They Doing Wrong? That is more of a confessional statement to you than it is anything else, because I know that in that little small voice that at least operates in the back of my head, that voice that starts saying things when I know better than to say them out loud, That voice has often responded to settings of congregational growth by saying, what are they doing wrong? The implication being that they must be compromising something somewhere if, in fact, a congregation is experiencing rapid growth. Now, I would suggest that there may be some statistics that would give some credence to that kind of a background. As I asked for statistics on the congregations in regions 1 through 4, that's, you know, like almost everything west of the Mississippi, there are 4,373 congregations in that geographic area. Slightly over 70% of those congregations did not grow by one person per year in their average worship attendance between 1988 and 1991. Those are the years that the church research department had in their computer. That's, to me, a rather substantial fact. If you look at the 1993 yearbook for the ELCA, which is the most recent set of statistics that I've been able to see church-wide, the 11,074 congregations that are part of this church had an increase of membership that exceeded the decreases. We did honestly grow in the most recent year. Church-wide, we grew by 5,821 folk. Now, understand, that's in a church of 5,245,177 people, or our growth was slightly less than 0.1%, which is not terrific. I think there are some reasons for that, by the way. I think one of the reasons for that is tied to folk like me. Quite honestly, I think that when I went through seminary, I was trained how to become a decent theologian. I was not trained how to become a decent evangelist. If, in fact, I was going to become an evangelist, then I signed up for World Mission because that's where the mission field was. And World Missions would have trained me to be an evangelist. Now, that's maybe I was weird going through seminary, but nonetheless, that's the way that it happened for me. I think that's one of the major factors. I think another major factor is that I think there are a lot of very tired clergy. Alban Institute in Washington, D.C., an ecumenical institute, has suggested that there's a difference between burnout and stress out. Burnout they defined as an overextension of coping mechanisms, stress out being an overextension of caring mechanisms. They suggested that parish clergy are in the same category as physicians in solo practice, that is, where there's no one else to hand off call to, and that they are the two vocational settings that are most susceptible to stress out, that overextension of caring mechanisms. And the quick test is, how many people are there that would call you at 2:30 in the morning and you'd get out of bed and respond to them and their needs now? And for clergy and for physicians, the answer is as many people who can call. Well, that's kind of the setting. There's another factor, I think, and that is that there have been some studies that have started to show that there's a lot of congregations in our church that are really not anxious to grow. And that's because I think there are some costs that are involved in it. And that's understandable. Okay? What I ended up doing is I ended up asking our research and evaluation department in Chicago to provide me a list of congregations where worship attendance was increasing each of the years between 88 and 91. What I thought I was going to get is that if each year it showed a growth, I would get the name. What I got was if 1991 showed one more in worship attendance than 1988 did in regions 1 through 4, I got the name. I ended up getting a list of 1,654 congregations. And my first reaction was, oh, geez, that's not what I asked for. That's way too many congregations. My second reaction was, is that all? In 4 years' time, or actually 3 years' time, because the first year is the base year in terms of this, in 3 years' time, one more in worship. Only 1,654 congregations. Now, of that group, there were 182 of them that were less than 10 years old, so I discounted them, remember, because I wanted established parishes. Then I put it through my own computer grid and asked how many have actually grown each year. And that reduced the pool to 108. And then I said I was looking for a congregations of 150 in worship attendance or more, and that reduced the pool to 78. And of that group, there were a number of congregations with less than 8% increase over the three-year time, and I didn't have demographics yet, and so quite honestly, I got real nervous with congregations that had shown less than an 8% growth in 3 years' time. And so I fudged. I went back to the list, and if there was a synod that hadn't shown in its congregations any growth from 1 year to the next, I made an assumption, in all due respect to some bishops' offices that are represented, I made the assumption that the bishops' offices didn't get their statistics in to Chicago in time. No doubt because the congregations didn't get it into them in time, but nonetheless, something happened, and Chicago listed everybody as having the same growth, having the same attendance. No growth, no decreases. So I looked at some of those and picked out some congregations that had grown at a rate of 30% over 3 years and substituted them for congregations that had grown less than 8%. Anyway, I submitted to Chicago for demographic statistics a group of about 73 congregations. And they sent back to me the zip code information from 1980 and 1990 census, which gave me a percentage of growth for the community in which the congregation was located. Now, I understand we've lost scientific value. I mean, this is not a scientific study. I don't claim it to be terrific at that way, but it was a way of doing some things, all right? What I ended up with was a pool of 33 congregations, and they were terrific. I augmented them by seven that didn't fit my grid because they were close by the ones that I visited. I ended up visiting 40 congregations in the time. We traveled in 22 states and over 21,000 miles and had a marvelous time. And I will tell you that it is absolutely terrific to be able to sit down with people in their offices and say to them, my grids say there are some good things going on here. Tell me about it. One of the things that I discovered very rapidly is that that was an enormous kind of shot in the arm that that someone was asking them what was going on there. It was an ego shot or whatever you wish to call it, and but it was fun to do that, simply to be able to get responses and reactions from congregations. So what did I discover? Well, I discovered, first of all, that what I was doing was in part a study of the obvious. I discovered that there wasn't a single one of those congregations that was growing that hadn't made an intentional decision to try and grow. So my theory would be to say, if a congregation has decided to try and grow, it's got a chance. If it hasn't made that decision, it doesn't have a chance. If it hasn't made the decision, it probably won't happen. And I also discovered that those who had decided to grow had found it to be painful because growth mandates change, and change is not comfortable. I found out that sometimes that decision had been made rapidly because people felt like, you know, do you want to grow? Was a question like, do you support motherhood and the flag? And of course they said yes. But in their innards, they really didn't want to do it. And sometimes that meant that those who were in leadership were feeling submarined partway through it. That they were being torpedoed because a decision had been made initially and now key folk were abandoning the process. And that hurt. The question that goes along with the intentional decision to grow is why? And there were a lot of folk who ended up saying that they found that there were a good deal of people in their congregations that decided they really wanted to grow, but the reason when they really started pressing it with them was they wanted more folk around to pay the bills. But they really didn't want more people around in terms of the changes that that was going to mean. The congregations that were growing because they also understood that it was a biblical admonition, that it was part of the commissioning that was given to us in Christ to proclaim, to teach, and to baptize. And what did that mean for their life? Well, let me try and illustrate something. I can tell you that that's a terribly important sentence. And I want you to know what that sentence says. Okay? Now, if I left you that way, okay? If I just left you with that, I'm curious. Well, I won't ask you, but there are some of you who no doubt would be able to figure it out. There are some of you who like a mystery or a puzzle and will keep working until you can figure it out. It may not be terribly obvious right at the start. Yeah? It's Greek letters. That's correct. I could give you that clue. Those are Greek letters. But they're not Greek words. No! They're not Greek words. That's right. Now I can tell you the rest of the clues, all right? I could do that, too. I could give you all of the clues. These are Greek letters, and this is transliteration of English words into Greek letters. Now, if in fact you are interested in learning Greek well enough to be able to do the transliteration, if you are willing to become like me and like others who already can read that paragraph, then you will get the important message. That's another way we can do things. If we do things that way, I would suggest that there can be a possible confusion as to whether or not the important part is learning the Greek letters or whether the important part is learning what the words say. Obviously, the third thing that we can do is we can transliterate the letters back into English letters. And if, in fact, you were to do that, it would say, "The God who created you loves you unconditionally." And what we need to be able to do is decide what we are going to do with the message that we have to give. We can lay it out in Greek. Well, we won't call it Greek, but we will call it what we have done in terms of our good, solid traditions. And if, in fact, people know those traditions, maybe what we are saying will be meaningful to them. If they don't know those traditions, we can say, well, learn the traditions, and then you will understand how meaningful the sentence is. Or maybe what we have to do within the context of the church is transliterate into a language that people know. That's not comfortable. That gets to be even more painful. One of the things that I discovered in the process was that there were some points of commonness beside the decision to grow. The physical plant of every congregation we visited that was growing was neat, clean, fresh. It looked like people gave a rip about what happened there. Okay? I will also tell you that I visited some congregations that weren't growing. And I will tell you there's an enormous difference between the two. I think most of us have signs in front of our churches, but I think most of us have signs that are for our congregations. Because, first of all, you can't see them. Secondly, you can't read information as you're driving by on the car. And thirdly, the information you can read isn't that valid. It didn't tell you anything that you really need to know. And then, you know, it goes from there. Okay? But congregations that are growing are trying to do some things about that. Their physical plant is appealing, and they are doing some very different things with signage. They are making that signage obvious and clear. They are, as congregations, really working at welcoming the stranger. Now, that's a nice catchphrase, and we use it a lot currently in the church. And I've tried to suggest that we have been welcoming of the stranger in my own parish, but I will tell you that we haven't even started to learn what the phrase means at Christ Lutheran Church in Edmonds. I found parking lots not only with visitor signs, but parking lots where folks are in the parking lot to help people, and that's the first set of the welcoming cadre core ministry. The folk that are trained to be in the parking lot to help between services, okay, help the flow. They aren't just there to direct traffic, they are there to be welcoming people, okay? By the time folk get to the building, they have probably been spoken to more than twice, and it's more than hello. It's something about the weather, maybe, something about the flowers, maybe, something about the spring, maybe, something about the building, maybe, something about the traffic, maybe, but it's something other than a nod and a hello. And it's often a, can I help you? The building itself is visitor-friendly. You want some fun sometime? Walk away from your church and walk back in thinking of another role. Think of yourself in somebody else's shoes. Don't look at it in your own shoes, because if you look at it in your own shoes, it's too easy to overlook the same stuff you've been overlooking all along anyway. Walk in with someone else's shoes on, all right? And ask yourself some things about your building. First of all, do you know, can you figure out where the doors are? That's not true at every church. And if you get inside, can you figure out immediately where you're supposed to go for various and sundry things? Is there a hint as to where the bathroom is? Is there a hint as to where the nursery is, or where the Sunday school is, or where the worship center is? What's the signage? Is it intended for visitor-friendly kinds of settings? Are there folks that are there to greet? Now let me tell you what my perception is with greeters, because I mean there are lots of folks that have got greeters that are standing by the door. Greeters who stand by the door are there to be able to give a perfunctory how do you do and shake hands, but they aren't supposed to say any more than that, because if they do, they're going to hold up the line. So visitors who are really able to, or greeters who are really able to function, are not stationed by a door. They're identified somehow, pin, sash, flowers, whatever, but they're moving around the whole welcoming area. So there are signs, there are greeters that are moving around, and there's often an information booth. And all three are very often present in congregations where there's growth. Okay? The involvement of children in worship is obvious. And that means from the point of walking in to whether or not there are some, you know, I mean, there are congregations that give out sacks of quiet activities or quiet toys. There are congregations who give out notebooks that are age kind of categorized for the kids for worship, because their attention span may not be as long. There are two tactics that are followed in terms of bulletins. Almost no one that in the growing congregations were using table of contents kinds of bulletins. That's what most of us, I think, end up using, except that we aren't complete with our table of contents. We only do the big things, okay? We do the salutation, we don't put in the response, and we'll probably forget the introduction to the prayer of the church. And, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff, if you look down the normal table of contents, bulletin type, that simply isn't there. I will also tell you that I have now experienced that look of total disdain when you drop your bulletin inserts for the second time in a worship service. It's that look that's reserved for your kids when your kids have been misbehaving and they should know better. I've gotten it. Because I dropped my bulletin inserts twice in the same worship service. And that was because I was trying to juggle inserts and bulletin and hymnal. And that was, you know, it was not a healthy setting. bulletins that are either printed out in their entirety or bulletins that are less than a table of contents, because everything that you are going to do is projected. It's in front of you. And that one is done intentionally by a number of congregations because they don't want people standing or sitting with their heads down. They want people looking up. And if they want people looking up, they project it up in front of the in the front on a front wall. Okay? So that bulletins are in those one, they're either projected, the whole service is either projected or the whole service is printed out in the most common of growth settings. In that process, in those congregations, there's an intentional process of visitor-friendly language. And for me, I will tell you that that inclusive language now means something more than just gender inclusive. It also means it means non-member inclusive. We use a lot of code in the Lutheran Church, and I'm as guilty of it as anyone is, and probably more guilty. I love using phrases like grace of God, because it carries so much wonderful baggage, and I can say it all in one easy phrase. And if you're educated in the Lutheran Church, and your baggage is the same as mine, you're going to know what I'm talking about. But I found a number of congregations who won't use that kind of stuff. They will talk about God's unconditional love instead of using phrases like grace of God. They will do all things possible to see to it the language that is being used is understandable by the non-churched visitor, so that that's not excluding them. Another one is that I have been very unpopular with some groups in my congregation, because every now and then we end up saying, okay, we're going to cut down these morning announcements, folks. We simply cannot take this much time in announcements. This is to be the worship hour. Every single one of these large congregations that were growing, announcements took 10, 15 minutes, because it's community building time. And it is a clear indication to the visitor as to whether or not there is community. It's the easiest way for a visitor to start to catch on to the fact that there is or is not community. And it was, I mean, it's an enormous frustration to have to, I will tell you that I've been dragged kicking and screaming to some of these positions, all right? But nonetheless, it is what I found, and I can understand it, because it was so obvious to walk into settings where that's what was happening and to walk into some others where that's not what was happening. Walk into a setting where the announcements are minimal or non-existent, and that can be an unbelievably sterile setting for a visitor. You know, walk into a setting where they're taking 10, 15 minutes talking about what went on last week, what's going to be going on this week, where there even can, and in some instances, some banter back and forth, you know, with folk in the congregation, and it gives a whole different tone and feel. There is an enormous debate about what you do to acknowledge this. There's and at this point there is no commonness except that you know, everyone has got their own theory, and they will hang to it. I mean, they'll hang on to it with unbelievable tenacity. There are some congregations that believe that name tags are absolutely essential, and there are other congregations that end up saying you never do name tags because the folk will never be back. And you never have people stand up, and others have them stand up. Okay? And you never pass things out to visitors, and others pass them out to visitors. So that's one of the places where I guess I'd end up saying you play your cards and you take your chances, and you're going to lose some. But be intentional about what you're doing.
The same thing can be said about following. There's enormous debate at that point.
For the sake of the full visit, or and that breadth is, there is no comment. But again, be intentional about what you are doing. One of the other common points for the whole out of after welcoming the stranger, because where we, as far as I'm concerned, what we've been talking about for the last number of things have been all part of the welcoming process, all part of hospitality. But one of the other common traits for congregations was that spirituality was taken very, very seriously. That is not to suggest that the spirituality of one congregation is in the same place as the spirituality of another. And in the Lutheran Church, to even start to use the term spirituality causes a whole lot of folks to scratch their head. I had more than one person say to me, "What are you really talking about when you're asking about spirituality?" All right. The facts are that that there's a wide spectrum, but what I would end up saying is a way of being able to characterize what I'm saying is that prayer is... Have you ever been in a setting where you walk out of it and say, you know, that person or that group, they really buy what they're praying. They really mean what they... I mean, prayer is really... It's serious for them. Huh? I've been in those, right? I will tell you that one of the clear differences that I saw in terms of congregational life, and I think I know most of the inserts that are published, no one used the prayer of the church from the petitions of the Green Hymnal or from Celebrate or from any of the other kinds of canned prayer settings. The prayer of the church was honestly the prayer of the church. It was a compiling of the prayer concerns of that congregation for that day, and it was obviously carefully written. And it was carefully involving that particular setting. And it would not be easily picked out or plucked out and put into another congregation because it wouldn't make as much sense to them. Okay? That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Spirituality was part of small group settings in congregations of growth. Bible study was a part of that. Some congregations absolutely refused to print or project Bible verse or Bible readings, but had everyone in the congregation at that point of the service pick out the hymnal out of the rack and open it, and they'd give page numbers, because they didn't want anyone to not know where Isaiah was or Amos was. And so they'd give page numbers, okay? But you know, scripture and readings of scripture and study of scripture was very, very significant in the life of growing congregations. There were congregations that were really working at getting people to be able to easily talk about their faith. If I were to ask you right now to think about a school teacher you had, or a professor you had in college, or you know, some teacher you have had sometime, someone who was for you really unique, would you find it easy to be able to talk to anyone about that school teacher? Probability is yes. Most folks find it easier to talk about a school teacher than they do to talk about their Lord. And that's part of what folks were working at trying to undo. Trying to make it as easy to be able to talk about our faith walk, as easy to talk about our Lord as it is to talk about a school teacher. Leadership was an important factor. Folk were not on staffs, were not carbon copies of one another. They were strong, self-assured. They were aware of what their roles were. They spoke easily about their faith. They were positive, confident in their perceptions of their congregations. They held an articulate vision of where the congregation was going and could be happy to talk about it. They were creative folk. They knew tradition, but they were also creative people. And they delighted in doing ministry. But a whole bunch of them were really tired. And I mean, real tired. Interesting part about governance of congregations, the larger the congregation, the smaller the board, and the less frequently they met, to the point of having a church council of 6 people that met quarterly. those were more and more staff-run congregations, and in those settings, they never spent time about who was going in a church council meeting, asking who was the plumber that they were going to call to fix the pipes in the, you know, in the men's room that were leaking. That was never even brought to the council. That kind of stuff was—that's all administrative stuff, and it's all taken care of. The relationship and rapport between the council and the staff is through the senior pastor, and in fact, the senior pastor is told, broad strokes, what they want done, not told how they want it done. And the other way around is that the council also addressed the congregation. If resources were inadequate, it was the council's job to address the congregation to increase the resources. It's an interesting kind of imagery. And in most of those settings, the interesting part is, most of those settings, the acknowledgement was made, it was terribly painful to change that government setting. And what they really wished was that all Christian congregations would start with that kind of governance. That does not mean to say that people were not involved. What we have done in the church is involve lots of people in lots of committees. In these settings, they were trying to involve lots of people in lots of ministry instead of in committee meetings. Isn't that an interesting, fun idea? Instead of spending time in committee meetings, we spend time doing ministry. These congregations had well-developed small group settings and well-developed youth ministries. But one of the primary areas of obvious difference was in the area of worship. And there's an enormous continuum of worship styles that exists in the congregations in question. There is an ellipse that sits over here that we will call traditional worship style. Or format. That's basically what I would define as green hymnal with all of its variations. There is another ellipse that overlaps that one, that for the sake of a title we will call a blended worship style. That either starts with a liturgy out of the green hymnal and uses contemporary hymnody, or more contemporary, you know, some of the contemporary hymnals, things like Ilvesacker hymns or Hans Hansen hymns. That may be code words again for some folk, but you know, it's more recently written music than the Green Hymnals publishing. Okay, or they are using something like a Marty Haugen liturgy with hymnody from the Green Hymnal. And what most pastors found is that in a blended service, which is a service they put together so that the change wouldn't be too jarring for people, what they found is that it usually succeeded in alienating everyone. Because those that wanted change weren't getting enough change, and those that didn't want you mucking around with what they loved didn't like the fact you were mucking around with half of it. Okay? So there's another ellipse which we will call a traditional alternative worship style. And that means it is a liturgical format, something akin to some of the things we do with Marty Haugen up at Holden sometimes, or some of the other services we've done up here, where you can, if you know the liturgical outline, you can go through and put the two side by side, and you say, ah, yes, here's the invocation here, here's the invocation here, here's the hymn of praise here, here's the hymn of praise here. They're different hymns of praise, different words, different music, but the flow is basically the same. Okay? That's what I would refer to as a traditional alternative worship style. There's another one. It's probably someplace over around here. And that is what I will simply call an alternative worship style, where where the liturgical flow is not perceivable, at least to my understanding, and the hymnody is more inclined toward what would be referred to as praise hymns. There are some interesting things that happen as you move back and forth in that flow. For now, I'll simply say that if you tell me what's going on in terms of where new members are coming from, all right, and that's one of the questions that I ask people, is put your new membership in three categories. One is letters of transfer. That is to say, they were actively involved in a congregation, be it Lutheran, Catholic, Methodist, whatever. But they were involved in a congregation. There was a life change event. Maybe their kids went off to a different school, or maybe they moved from one community to another. But there's been some kind of a change, and they have moved from one congregation to another. There's been very little time in between, except they had to take time to find the new congregation. Now, they may have gone through catechetical instruction. They may have done a lot of those things, but nonetheless, no big gaps in between. That's transfers. Reaffirmations are the same kind of thing. Doesn't matter where they come from, what their background was. They were in a church once upon a time. There's 3, 5, 7 years of no participation, and now activation again. That's what I would refer to as reactivation. And the third one is folk that are honestly new to the faith. Give me the percentages of where your membership is coming from, and I'll tell you what's going on here in terms of worship. If it's here, if it's in the traditional form, if that's where the primary group is coming from, the prediction is that music is outstanding, that the youth program is excellent, and that there is probably conflict in neighboring congregations somewhere. Okay? If the emphasis starts to move down here to some of the more alternative styles, that will be reflective by people who are reactivation or new to the faith. But there isn't a lot of reactivation and new to the faith in the traditional worship style. Okay? Music is really important, without question. And under normal circumstances, the musicians are professional. And in most instances, they're paid. Yes? It depends on the congregation. The question is, do they stick with one style or are there multiple styles? Most congregations have at least two styles. They have what they will call a traditional worship or a more traditional worship, and they will call a more alternative worship style. Okay, a traditional style and a more alternative style. Sometimes what they are referring to as a traditional worship style in the Northwest would have been jarringly alternative. Okay? At least, it's just there's enormous breadth, okay? But they'll have a couple. The question is, when? If, in fact, you were to pull the person on the street who's not part of the church and were to ask them, when does church happen? I suspect most of them wouldn't say Saturday night at 8. I suspect most of them wouldn't say Sunday morning at 7. My guess is most of them would say Sunday morning, 11 o'clock. Now, if that's the folk you're going for, the non-churched, that's when the alternative worship probably should be. Because if that's what they're going to come to check out, you know, that's what you're trying to address, it seems to me you put those two together. It's the other thing that most folk have decided is that, you know, the question has been asked of the congregation, how much do we care about those who are non-churched? Do we care enough to give up some of the things that we find have been meaningful to us? At least in terms of service times. Some congregations have said no. Some have said yes. Let me quickly give you my top 10. All of us do cards, I think all of us do cards that welcome, you know, or a letter to welcome people who have been visitors. A lot of us do. But when people join, I've always asked them, what brought you here? What kept you here? But in the process, I have weeded out all negatives. Because I've never asked the people that don't come back, what do we need to do that, you know, Well, there's a congregation that in the welcoming letter sends out a self-addressed stamped card saying, what brought you here? What did we do well? What do we need to work on? It was an interesting kind of process of not weeding out, right? Stamped self-addressed, yes. There's congregations that do trained hospitality corps. That is to say, all greeters, ushers, nursery attendants, anyone who is likely to be coming in contact with a visitor gets trained specifically to talk about that process. And in one setting, there are nursery attendants who, any visitor who leaves a child in the nursery and there's a diaper bag with that child, there will be a note in that diaper bag before the service is over talking about something outstanding about that child. Your child has got the biggest, bluest eyes, most wonderful eyes. Your child has got the neatest smile. Your child has got the best laugh. Something positive about the child will be in a note from the nursery attendant in the diaper bag. Another congregation changes all diapered children 10 minutes before the worship service is over. Hey? You want dry kids going out of there, or do you want wet kids going out of there, right? And on every one of those diapers is a sticker, because this happened to be Lord of Life Lutheran Church, that says, Lord of Life loves kids. On the diaper. Okay? Greeters are floating, and when someone says, where's the nursery, they don't just point to it. They say, come with me. I'm Bob, and you are, and they get, their task is to take them where their person is asking for and to find out who the person is and what community they are from, because Sunday night, the person who brought them to the nursery is to have called them and said, hi, I'm Bob, I'm the one that took you to the nursery. How did your visit go? Was there something we can do to become more visitor-friendly? Another one, choirs practice before the service, not downstairs, or out of the way. They practice in the sanctuary. And they finish 5 minutes before worship begins, and their task for 5 minutes is to greet everyone in the congregation. They work the congregation. For the 5 minutes before worship begins, they all come back out of the congregation. No one in the congregation should be there without being greeted by some member of the choir. That's their primary task. Member, visitor, whatever. Choir greets everyone. I said about inclusive language. There's one pastor who uses his grammar checker. He said it's not a very expensive grammar checker. In fact, it's so cheap that any of the liturgical words aren't in it. Any of the Lutheran theological words aren't in it. So it flags all of those. So he runs everything through his grammar checker, and anything that's flagged, he changes the language. Okay? Quick way of being able to do it. Parish nurses are starting to be a wonderful addition to ministry, and congregations, a quick way of being able to do it is a congregation buys the liability insurance, asks the nurses in the congregation if they will volunteer one day per week, or a half day per week, or a couple of hours per week, or so they set it up, and they are there simply to answer the questions from people who are asking, do I really need to go see a doctor about this? Or they are checking with some of the elderly, or they are checking on folk who are taking meds, are they really taking them? They are functioning as a resource person within the congregation. And the last one, I guess, is 20 notes a week written by the clergy to folk for whatever reasons, other than birthdays and anniversaries. Two lines, no more than. For whatever. Understand you were, to a little girl, understand you were going, were wondering about your tonsillectomy. When you go to the hospital, I'll see you there. Who knows? Anything that he's heard, he'll write a note for. In terms of hospitality and tone within the congregation, did some good things. We don't have a lot of time. there are two things that I didn't like, by the way, that I found that really bothered me. Larger congregations that are growing, baptism is no longer part of the corporate setting. Baptism has become private and family, and it's not in the corporate nature, and it's not there because they understand that they are going for the baby boomer and the baby buster, and the baby boomer and the baby buster don't want to be told they're not acceptable as they are. And that starts to talk about a haves and have-nots, and so they put baptism into a private act. That bothers me. It equally bothers me that all a person does to join the congregation, Lutheran or not Lutheran, is fill out a half sheet of paper. But that's also true in a lot of the larger growing congregations. And that one, you know, those are some things that I struggled with yet. Pardon? Membership in a congregation is determined by whether or not you have filled out a half sheet information form. Name, address, phone number. Not in some. And that bothers me.
How long is the average length of service in these congregations?
About 50 minutes, 50 to 55 minutes.
Including announcements?
Including announcements.
Communion?
Including communion. Yes.
Confession.
Do they use confession? In everything down to here, yes. In this one, no. Pardon? This is clearly for seeker, for non-believer. Okay? No robes. And in some instances, no altar. Tending to be more conservative. Yeah. I mean, they may be using non-traditional language, but belief system is really pretty solid. Except for communion, except for, you know, membership expectation, adjoining expectations.
Leaning toward fundamentalism or conservatism?
I would leave it at that point, conservative Lutheran. I mean, very solidly Lutheran. I haven't found their findings yet. I've asked for it when it comes out, and I don't believe the report is out yet.
May 30th it was out.
It was. Right. Wonderful. I hope that I can get one. But I haven't got it yet. It depends on the congregation. These congregations, by the way, ranged in age from 12 years old to 112 years old. No, 108 years old, excuse me, not 112. 12 years old to 108 years old. So there's enormous breadth.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. The buildings were not necessarily all new.
No, not new, but fresh paint.
Yeah.
You know, and clean, and hospitable.
Do these tend to be high commitment or low commitment churches?
Depends on the congregation. Both were there. Yes.
What about the cultural differences?
What about cultural? It depended on the congregation. There were some congregations that were strongly multicultural. Congregation in Houston, Texas is white is minority. But there are other congregations where that's not the case. It's all there. Yes.
What do you think surprised you most, Bob? Go ahead.
The breadth of worship. I told you, I've been dragged kicking and screaming. Someone said probably the most succinct line, the Lutheran Church has had a rich and relevant music heritage. And currently, the Lutheran Church has a rich music heritage. And boy, that smarts for me. Because it's still relevant to me. But there's, you know, I mean, but the breadth of, you know, the breadth of the worship experience. When you start talking about a worship setting led by a choir or a vocal group and clergy, none of whom are wearing robes, with no altar present, and you're functioning off a stage, that I didn't expect.
A cross?
Let me stop and think. Yes, cross was there.
But you did find congregations that were doing very traditional,
absolutely,
the rich Lutheran heritage.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. It depends on where the growth is coming from.
Yeah.
Not always. Yes.
No.
Well, we're close. I mean, we're getting there. I thought there was one.
And I can't even remember the name now, but it was, you know, it was a name that to me was female. And my surprise was when this guy walked in. And it was my disappointment also.